Hey, it's the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and with me as always is Steve. How are you doing?
John, I'm Will. How's it going?
I'm doing much better than Peloton.
I think everyone is.
The layoffs are coming. Yeah, they're going to cut $2,800 people, which is a lot of dollars, and the CEO is leaving. So is that the end of the pandemic, the lockdowns kind of effect? Hopefully we're getting into normal life where you don't just bike indoors?
Bike back outside. Good question. I think we've talked about all these sort of pandemic influence companies, right? I think Zoom is the one that's here to stay. I'm not sure about Peloton, but I think Peloton actually, I've seen reports of some interest from either Nike or Amazon, which makes sense as well, right? Given their core audiences. So I think they'll be fine in the long term. It's just a matter of finding where they will end up. And now that they're cheap, they make for a really good target mark.
And, you know, this is tied into fintech because a firm was so reliant on Peloton sales during the whole pandemic. They really shot up.
They were. Yeah, I think they accounted for maybe a quarter of a firm's volume was through Peloton or some massive number. It seems like a huge risk, but seems to have worked for them.
They're certainly not as far down as Peloton has gone down.
That's good to hear.
A firm hanging in there, diversifying. You should always diversify your portfolio.
Yes, you should, actually. Yes. Great segue. You should.
And well, actually, this week, we're lucky to have someone who knows a bit about portfolios and diversification and the benefits of long-term planning. We have Mike Shaw, the CEO and co-founder of Sigfig. Welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great. So how did the pandemic treat you guys, and how is it changing now that we're, fingers crossed, coming out of it?
Well, first, it's been quite the exciting journey to have a 1 month old when the pandemic started. So from a personal perspective, that was a fun ride, lots of extra time at home with the kids. From a work perspective, it was kind of a fascinating, you know, last couple of years. You know, obviously, we've all had a front row seat to experiencing what, you know, the pandemic has done to our own, you know, kind of personal lives. But I must say, you know, for business, you know, if you run a bank in 2022 and, you know, digital transformation hasn't become, you know, a top priority, you're probably somewhat of an alien. So, you know, it's been quite good for our growth and momentum.
So you're doing better than Peloton and and Facebook actually lately in tanking. So that's good to hear. A lot of fintechs, and specifically, I kind of noticed with the wealth tech side of it, like partnering and a lot of acquisition activity has been going on. UBS just bought Wealthfront, and it looks like a lot of the big banks see this as a key product set to have. How has that affected you guys?
Yeah, it's been kind of all good. I'd say, you know, you're right. You know, there's kind of two big trends that you know, we're able to kind of ride the kind of macro wave on. One is just overall, you know, investment in digital transformation, the importance of, you know, interacting with your customers in new ways, you know, the world that is moving away from kind of physical in-store, in-branch banking to, you know, much more virtual banking. You know, all of those trends, I mean, I'm sure we all have experienced that as consumers across, you know, many, many different kind of product verticals. So, you know, that's been, you know, kind of a great trend. And then, you know, I think when you look at wealth management, it's become a more and more and more important business line for a lot of banks. You know, in the past, people thought of the wealth management business as primarily a kind of a product and a business for really just like the wealthiest of the bank's clients. You know, that's mm-hmm. why a lot of banks have private banking divisions that are aimed at, you know, kind of multimillionaires. But, you know, over the last few decades, you know, investing has become much more accessible to the average consumer. And, you know, the banks, you know, would love to, you know, be a part of offering consumers those services. And so kind of that combination of both wealth management as well as, you know, digital transformation, you know, they kind of sit right at the crossroads of what we do.
Looking at the Sigfig history, you guys began as a consumer play and then you pivoted to the enterprise side, right? So you became a white label provider for banks, right?
Yeah, that's right. You know, in our early years, you know, we've been around a little bit longer than, you know, the kind of average fintech, you know, we were more consumer oriented. You know, a lot of our kind of company DNA is around customer experience and innovation and design and usability and things like that. And, you know, we pivoted to B2B quite some time ago because, you know, I think our view was that, you know, if you think about how consumers adopt financial products, you know, a lot of who they adopt through are financial institutions. And it turns out, you know, our capabilities and our offerings are really complementary to, you know, what banks have and what banks need. And, you know, we just saw a really interesting path to, you know, focus on impacting a lot more consumers by reaching them through large partners.
So is most of your AUM now held by your partner institutions, or is it direct consumer stuff?
Yeah, we don't break out the exact figures, but yeah, I'd say the vast majority of our kind of AUM and our scale, you know, comes through our partners. You know, I'm sure we'll kind of get into it in a little bit, but one of the things that is also kind of interesting about Sigfig is, even though, you know, we started our enterprise journey in offering, you know, kind of digital investing as a solution, we've actually since expanded quite a bit to, you know, quite a bunch of other new, you know, product lines and kind of problems that we're trying to solve for our partners. So, you know, we're actually much more than a kind of a wealth and investing, you know, company now.
But what kind of demands are those these days?
Yeah, you know, there's a couple areas that, you know, I think we've been kind of really focused on in terms of our innovation and our roadmap. They all relate to kind of two core themes that, you know, are central to kind of our view on the future. One is what we call the grand inversion. And it's kind of a fancy name for a simple concept, which is essentially that, you know, the vast majority of financial institutions are actually built around a physical first operating model. You know, the place that you go to work with a banker, to get advice, to have, you know, kind of a rich relationship-based conversation, you know, that all still happens, you know, in the branch. And digital is kind of a channel where, you know, clients can go to self-serve, you know, check a balance, pay a bill, deposit a check. And what the inversion part of this is that actually a lot of those value creating activities that, you know, historically have happened in the branch, you know, they're all moving digital. And so, you know, that's going to cause a lot of financial institutions to need new kinds of capabilities to be able to actually do those things that they used to do in the branch, to do them well, you know, in virtual channels. So, you know, that's kind of one big theme that kind of explains a lot of what we do. And then the other kind of big theme is what we call customer closeness. And, you know, the way I like to kind of describe this is that, you know, a lot of financial institutions strive to have really deep kind of close relationships with their customers. And they actually used to be really successful at that. So, you know, it was only 30 years ago that, you know, the average consumer actually had to go into a bank branch every week to either deposit a paycheck or withdraw money. And that frequent kind of foot traffic allowed the bankers in the branch to get to know the clients and vice versa. And it was through that kind of relationship-based banking that banks were able to really know their customers. Now, as you can imagine, as you know, the demographic of clients going into the branch change and the volume of people using the branch goes down over time, you know, the digital channels are actually where, you know, the consumers are really kind of interacting with the bank. And yet, you know, most banks haven't really figured out how to do some of that rich consultative relationship-based banking, you know, digitally. And so those are kind of two big themes that, you know, drive a lot of our innovation. When it comes to, you know, the actual products that we've built, you know, happy to talk more about those, but, you know, happy to, you know, first at least share with you, you know, kind of the bigger picture of kind of what we're all about.
Sure. Yeah. So what is coming around the horizon? It seems like there's a lot of focus on the automated financial plans, driving down that cost, addressing ESG and increasingly socially responsible investing. What other trends do you see coming down the line that you're either addressing or getting ready for?
Yeah, it's funny. It's a great question. You know, in some of the things you asked about, it actually reminds me of a broader point, which is, you know, a lot of people think of investment and investment advice as wealth management from the lens of like investing strategy and investment products. So whether that's trading stocks, ESG, you know, tax loss harvesting, you know, a lot of the kind of early themes that, you know, people talk about when they think about, you know, innovation in the investment industry, they actually revolve around what we consider to be investment products. And as much as that is a big part of, you know, kind of where we're innovating and where we're continuing to kind of invest and, you know, build out more and more solutions, actually, I think the more important transformation that is around the corner for this industry is innovation that's less at the investment product level or the investment strategy level, and more thinking about investment as a wealth management service. Yeah. And so, you know, I think the average consumer is not always thinking about investing from the lens of like asset classes or performance or yield or, you know, things that investment professionals tend to kind of geek out on. They're actually thinking about it from the lens of, you know, how can I save for retirement? How can I pay for my kids' college education? How can I, you know, buy a home one day? And those are more the kinds of things on their mind. They also think about stuff like, you know, what do I do if, you know, there's, you know, a rainy day? You know, can I weather a storm? You know, what's the best way to kind of, you know, reduce the amount of taxes that I pay? You know, those are kind of more everyday things on people's minds.
Speaking of transformations, it seems like there's kind of there has been a bit of a glut, I'd say, in terms of wealth management options now for consumers. How do you say you can differentiate SIGFIX from what everyone else is doing in terms of, you know, we mentioned Betterment and Wealthfront and Personal Capital? It seems like there's a lot of players in this space. How can you make sure that what you offer is actually addressing the needs of your consumers, which in your case would be banks or FS?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It's kind of watching the industry evolve, both from the incumbents' perspective as well as the kind of disruptive fintech perspective. I think a lot of firms are all kind of vying for the same thing, which is to be a true end-to-end provider for, you know, as much of the client's financial needs as possible. So, you know, on the fintech side, you're hearing that come up as, you know, as a super app. On the bank side, it's actually a very different kind of mindset. But I think everyone's going after the same thing, which is instead of selling products, you know, be it checking accounts or credit cards or mortgages or investments, how can we be like a full end-to-end financial provider, you know, for the client's needs? And so, you know, when you think about differentiation, you know, one of the advantages that incumbents have is they have a massive core franchise. You know, you think about all the bank brands that we know. I mean, they have tens of millions of customers today who might not be taking advantage of the full offering. You know, you may have a credit card with one bank, a checking account with a different bank, an investment provider, you know, being a third, you know, bank. And as a result, you're actually not getting as good of an overall experience as you could be if, you know, if one provider kind of really could provide for all your needs. And so, you know, for the incumbents, I think it's all about building a more integrated experience, one where you can kind of treat the customer as a whole customer instead of, you know, kind of different independent siloed customers of different products that you sell. And it turns out, you know, technology will have a lot of kind of positive impact on making that happen effectively for the bank. From the fintech perspective, you know, I think what they, you know, will struggle with is, you know, they're going to be usually more tech savvy, a little bit more nimble, more innovative, but they don't have as big of a core franchise, both in terms of install base, as well as kind of brand and trust that, you know, gets built over a long period. And so, you know, they're kind of coming from the other end where, you know, they maybe have some more of the innovation DNA, but they don't have as much of the you know, kind of incumbent advantages. And, you know, firm to firm, it varies, but there's also a huge range on, you know, how well fintechs have done in terms of being compliant with regulations and, you know, kind of friendly with regulators and things like that. So, you know, lots to be sorted out in the coming decade. It'll be a fascinating, you know, kind of next 10 years for the industry. But, you know, one thing I'm pretty confident is it's going to continue to be a very multi-player industry. So it's not going to be, you know, winner take all, like, you know, some of the big tech platforms have become, you know, like the FANG companies. Financial services has always been a highly fragmented industry with lots of players in lots of different verticals. And, you know, I think that explains a lot of why we have, you know, focused on B2B is because almost every single one of those companies is not really a technology at the core. You know, they're not a technology company. They don't have the kinds of, you know, kind of talent and culture and DNA that technology companies tend to have. And so it's going to be a really important part of their successful future to be kind of working with companies who are really great at software. And so, you know, that's kind of some of how things, you know, I think will play out over the coming years.
And is your vision to essentially create, or rather to launch more products that can be used by your partner companies as well, so that they can sort of offshore that to you guys? Or are you looking to stay focused within the wealth management space? And I'm thinking here, you know, what's stopping, say, other companies in the white label robo-advisor space from coming up with other solutions or other tools for customers to kind of capture them as they go through their financial journey? And, you know, and to add on to that as well, you mentioned the super app space. I don't see what's a barrier for, say, you know, a Coinbase or a Robinhood, speaking of regulations, to launch products that could be, if not competing, at least adjacent to what you guys offer. So what's sort of your vision for how much stuff you can bundle into the Sigfig product?
Yeah, you know, without taking you on kind of a long detour of, you know, kind of financial technology history, I'll give you the kind of quick version of it. You know, there's been a few eras where software has been kind of rapidly adopted by banks. I think the first era probably started like, I don't know, like 60, 70 years ago, you know, with the mainframe system, you know, like literally before, you know, kind of modern computing, you know, banks' books and records were held in, you know, file cabinets and, you know, signature cards stored at the bank. And, you know, like as a very analog world of kind of keeping track of your money. You may even be familiar with, you know, in the early days of savings accounts, they had this product called Passbook Savings, you know, where you used your passbook to, you know, kind of track your account balances. And so, you know, in the first era, you know, the first thing was actually just to start pulling stuff out of file cabinets, putting them into databases. And those early databases were mainframes, right? So that was kind of one big transformation. And over the years, you know, that core infrastructure, you know, that core banking system has slowly become more modern. But you'd be surprised at how many banks still run their core off of old legacy mainframe systems that, you know, they can barely find the programmers who can kind of keep them up to date. I'd say the next phase, you know, that is really kind of meaningful is probably when the modern internet really started to become, you know, a meaningful part of our lives. And that led to, you know, think of what mobile banking or digital banking is today. It's essentially a portal where a customer can go to self-serve. You know, you can log into your bank, see your balances, maybe pay a bill, deposit a check. But the digital experiences are really primarily transactional. You know, it's designed to be kind of very simple actions and very self-service oriented. And this next phase of banking, you know, the one that I think we're just entering is one that's, you know, trying to move the whole operating system of the bank into a digitally first world. And what that means is, you know, digital is not just going to be the place where you can kind of check a balance, pay a bill. It's going to be the place where you can really, really kind of richly interact with your bank. And that means, you know, it's probably the place where you can turn to for financial planning and advice. It's probably the place you can turn to to actually talk to people who work for the bank that you are a customer of. And so, you know, all of that's going to require a completely new set of technologies, a completely new set of capabilities. And those capabilities are really not being built by the incumbent tech providers. So, you know, when you look at the companies that have become most successful at selling software to banks, they're primarily today a lot of the core infrastructure companies. And so I think, you know, there is emerging kind of a next gen provider of kind of newer, more modern, more cloud-based technology to financial institutions. You know, we're one of a few that have really gotten traction and have signed on some, you know, just really great name brand blue chip clients. And, you know, I think that is part of what's difficult about breaking into this space. You know, it's very hard to just like start a B2B, you know, fintech company and sell to banks from scratch. You know, the banks, they're very needy clients. You know, they have a lot of regulations they have to comply with. They have a lot of security rules that you have to, you know, kind of meet. And, you know, they really put their providers through their paces. And in fact, they're required to by their regulators. So, you know, I think part of, you know, Sigfig's advantage is that, you know, we've built a trusted reputation in the industry. We continue to innovate and, you know, build lots of new products, but, you know, we're kind of a known trusted provider that, you know, has built a strong reputation. And so, you know, we're, to your question of, you know, are we looking to do more? You know, we absolutely are.
So any obstacles that you'd like to see removed? What's keeping you from growing to the next step?
I think there are a couple things that come to mind. You know, none of these are probably going to be surprising. One is, you know, just the continuous war on talent. You know, we operate in an industry where, you know, our people are really our kind of most important asset. And so, you know, continuing to attract great talent as we scale the company and the team, you know, is kind of a big focus.
Are you completely remote these days, or you guys go into an office?
Yeah, so we are still operating remotely. We do have offices across the world. We've got 6 different offices, but all of them have kind of remained closed. You know, I think we're probably on the eve here of turning the corner, hopefully, knock on wood. But we have actually always been really remote friendly. So it wasn't the pandemic that triggered us to be kind of remote friendly. You know, we're probably a little bit different than the typical early stage startup. You know, when we were less than 20 people, we actually opened up our second office. And, you know, that was more than 10 years ago. So, you know, for a long time, you know, we've had our teams collaborating remotely. And probably the one change that the pandemic has accelerated is, you know, before the pandemic, you know, I'd say probably 10-15% of our team was kind of truly remote, you know, like not located near an office. Today, that number has gone up a lot. So, you know, we've seen, you know, a lot of people joining Sigfig, even if they don't live, you know, near one of our 6 offices. So
the war for talent, that seems like at every level, from McDonald's up to CEOs, it's tough to get people and keep them. What other obstacles or challenges do you see?
You know, another area that, you know, to me is kind of a classic hard choice to make is, you know, how much to focus on the core franchise that's already gotten lots of traction and, you know, continues to kind of exhibit lots of growth versus allocating resources to kind of new emerging opportunities. You know, you kind of want to be a company that focuses, so you do a small number of things really well, but you kind of have that endless ambition to kind of keep doing more. And so, you know, Sigfig, you know, I think one of the things that we've really tried to kind of get right in that puzzle is actually less about resource allocation and more about kind of culture. The kinds of teams and talent and problems you solve when you're scaling an existing business versus you're building kind of a new product from scratch, they're actually quite different. And, you know, we very intentionally tried to make sure that we don't end up building teams and cultures that are kind of like the average of everything, you know? So if you have really innovative versus really, you know, kind of reliable enterprise scaling, you know, teams, you know, you don't want to be somewhere in the middle of that. You actually want to let some teams be really disruptive and really creative and really innovative while you let other teams focus on scale and reliability and, you know, kind of the five nines element of, you know, making sure that, you know, the product, you know, is totally robust and bulletproof. And so kind of creating different teams with different strengths all within the same company, you know, I think we feel like that's a big part of continuing to be innovative over time. You know, a lot of times you see startups as they get scale and as they become more and more mature, you know, things really start to slow down. It becomes a lot harder to launch new products, attract people who can build new great products. And so, you know, we've tried to stay ahead of that because, you know, we want to continue that kind of innovation sprint for, you know, forever, but we also want to make sure that, you know, we have like a really stable, secure platform, you know, for all the big clients that we already serve.
Yeah, that's tough keeping that balance. And some people, you see companies go one way or the other and have issues. Any advice you would give to people starting their technology company or fintech company? Like mistakes that you see, like, oh, I can't believe they're doing that, or things like that?
You know, one area that, you know, I think we got lucky in the early days and then we were intentional over time actually has to do with fundraising. You know, the kind of flashy Silicon Valley, you know, kind of ethos is sometimes boiled down to like raise as much money as at as high a valuation as possible. And I think our orientation has always been to raise money from really high quality, you know, firms and people in particular who can really, you know, help add value.
Open doors and like be a strategic partner to the business.
Yeah.
Not just the biggest check.
Exactly. So, you know, if I rewind the clock to the beginning days of SigFig and I pictured raising a lot more money at a really high valuation, you know, I bet we wouldn't have been as successful as, you know, kind of raising the right amount of money at a reasonable valuation, but really focusing on making sure we're raising from really high quality, you know, investors. And so I think that's kind of one tip I'd offer to, you know, people thinking about starting companies. You know, like sometimes people make the analogy that raising money and choosing an investor is like getting married. And then sometimes people joke because like you can't really get divorced easily from your investors. So, you know, choose those partners wisely because, you know, you'll probably be collaborating with them for a really long time. And, you know, life is short, you know, it's much better to kind of have the right people around the table who, you know, you really enjoy working with versus, you know, optimizing for like a couple percentage points of dilution. So, you know, that's kind of one tip I might offer.
Or anything that you would have done different, like when you guys started, you're like, oh, I wish I'd known that.
Invest in Bitcoin.
Right, yeah. Right. Like that. But
a year ago. Yeah.
Even a year ago would have been good. Yeah.
It's funny. One of the things I'm thinking about is kind of a paradoxical statement, which is on the one hand, you know, I think fintech is evolving more rapidly than I think it really ever has been in history. You know, like when I think about when we started the company, the pace of innovation, the pace of change, you know, was nowhere near what it is today. So on the one hand, you know, I think that's true. And yet on the exact other hand, everything in fintech seems to take a lot longer than in, you know, other verticals. And so how do you balance those both being true? In terms of how do you run your company, how do you allocate your resources, and what do you kind of go after? It's like a tricky, delicate balance. And, you know, knowing kind of where you are in fintech and which one of those truths is more accurate, you know, can be an important part of, you know, kind of coming up with the winning strategy.
So how has the demand for, or have you seen the demand for cryptocurrencies in people's portfolios affect your business very much?
Not yet. But I'm sure, you know, as the industry matures, that, you know, crypto will just become, you know, a logical part of, you know, what a portfolio should be. So I think the bigger question is, you know, in the early days of any new emerging technology, you get a lot of kind of pure pay standalone providers. You know, so you think about Coinbase, you think about all those early crypto brokerages, and all they do is crypto, right? And that was an era where the crypto providers did crypto, the non-crypto providers did not do crypto. And I think where things will get interesting is when you realize that for the average consumer, you know, crypto should neither be 0% of your portfolio, nor should it be 100% of your portfolio. You know, it should be part of your overall money strategy. And what that means is those kind of pure play providers are all going to need to figure out how to no longer be pure play, or at least play well with, you know, the other providers who, you know, may not be providing the piece that
they're like one of many asset classes.
Exactly. So I think,
well, a small percent, not the alternative percent even.
Right. So as crypto really goes mainstream, you know, you're going to see a situation where it's part of an overall strategy. And I think the firms that kind of get that blend right and, you know, offer a holistic offering instead of, you know, a very kind of siloed specific offering, you know, they're probably going to do a better job meeting the customer's actual needs. And that's different than the early adopter, you know, audience. You know, the early adopter is both more risk-taking, you know, they're more likely to kind of do stuff on their own so they can kind of compose their own portfolio across a variety of different providers. You know, your average kind of Main Street American is probably not going to be doing all that. And, you know, is looking for like a simpler, more turnkey solution.
Yeah. Diversifying across different cryptocurrencies is not what we're talking about.
Exactly.
It's just.
Yeah. So I think we're probably just about to kind of enter that phase where as it becomes more and more mainstream, you know, people start to really think about how these kind of products get integrated. Actually, a good kind of analogy of this, I don't know if you remember, you know, the late 90s and the first kind of internet banks. You know, those first internet banks, you know, they were internet only. And none of the big banks, you know, did, you know, had anything to do with the internet. And, you know, that was kind of the first phase of it. But obviously over time, you know, those worlds converged and, you know, basically every bank became a digital bank because like, how could you not, right? So that integration phase is kind of where I'd say the mass market opportunities really get made. And I think we're just entering that, you know, for crypto as an asset class.
Down the line. Yeah. So where is Sigfig going to be in 3 years? What would you like to see happen?
I'd say you're
buying out Coinbase and Robinhood.
Offering crypto.
Hopefully we're touching, almost everyone in the markets that we serve. That's one of the beauties of being kind of a B2B provider is, you know, I think as a direct-to-consumer player, you have aspirations to serve every customer, and you also know at the same time that you will never serve every customer. Whereas on the B2B side, I mean, there's no reason why we couldn't be serving, you know, almost every financial institution with the variety of different products that we've created. So, you know, a big part of, you know, the next 3 years is just kind of emerging from, you know, being kind of a robo-advisor, you know, B2B provider to really being a full end-to-end, you know, digital transformation provider to, you know, all the financial institutions in the world. So, you know, for sure, that'll be part of what we do. I obviously continue to believe that, you know, we're kind of early in the phase of kind of fintech innovation. So, you know, hopefully if we've done our job right, you know, the pace of innovation has continued to accelerate. You know, some of the areas that we're probably most passionate about today is building on our kind of digital wealth franchise. You know, the next big phase that, you know, we see coming is enabling really rich remote interactions. So if you think about, you know, the way consumers interact with their banks, you know, a lot of that kind of rich human face-to-face interaction model has been built around the fact that, you know, financial products are scary to buy. You know, a lot of consumers find them confusing. They don't know exactly, you know, kind of what products to buy, how to use them. And that's why financial advisors, insurance agents, small business bankers, mortgage loan officers. You know, that's why there are all these specialists that exist in the world to help make these products more approachable to the average consumer. But the silly thing is, you know, as an industry, you know, the incumbents have kind of forced consumers to come to their stores. You know, they have to come to the bank branch to do business with the bank. And, you know, that made a lot of sense when, you know, there was a lot of cash involved, you know, because, you know, you couldn't do that virtually. But, you know, pretty much every financial product these days, you know, can be purchased remotely. You know, there's no real reason why, you know, I should have to go and drive to a bank branch to do business with my bank. And, you know, again, that's going to require a whole new suite of technologies and capabilities that, you know, the bank doesn't really have today.
So you have a lot of work to do ahead of you. A lot of the technologies are coming down the pike and expanding to as many partners to reach as many very happy customers as you can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Great, great. Well, yeah, good luck with that. Keep up the good work with doing that, with keeping people responsible with their investing and growing further.
Yeah, no, thank you. It's been a nice chatting with you all, and you know, excited to see what the next few years brings for fintech and for Sigfig.
I'm sure there'll be plenty of surprises for for both of those. Yeah,
no doubt.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. That's Mike Shaw, the co-founder and CEO of Sigfig. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news, and thank you for listening.